This is Ella Maisano. I'm here with Lindsay Carlson at the West Hollywood Library. It is November 3rd, 2019. Let's get started. Okay. So first, where were you born? What was your childhood like? Just kind of tell me a little bit about your formative years.
Sure. I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and grew up in a suburb of St. Paul called Eagan, E-A-G-A-N. Mm-hmm. Was born on November 24th of 1979. I'm about to be 40 later this month. My childhood was great. It was kind of your typical late Gen X childhood. So by that, I mean it was in suburban childhood in particular. A lot of like playing outside with my friends. You know, this is sort of before like the digital age, I guess you could say. Computers kind of came about like while I was a kid, but most people didn't have them at home yet. So we would go out to the park, bike around the neighborhood, you know, and a lot of sort of kind of fantasy role-playing stuff, like I guess with my other girlfriends when I was little. It was a great childhood.
Mm-hmm. What was your family like?
My mom and my dad, married in 1970, so they're coming up close on their 50th anniversary right now. They're still together. I have a brother who is 2 years younger than me, was 3 years behind me in school just because I was a little advanced, I guess you could say. I mentioned this to you earlier before the interview, but I graduated when I was 17.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, awesome. So would you say that growing up, most of your friends were also girls, or would you say it's pretty even?
That's a good question. Probably mixed, because most of my friends were in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of girls, but also a lot of boys too. Generally my age and a little bit older than me, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. What was your education like elementary through high school, college, etc.? How do you think that kind of shaped where you are today?
Wow. Okay, so I mean, I'm one of those people, I guess, that's lucky to have grown up in the same house that from birth until when I graduated from high school. Went to a public school the entire way from elementary school, middle school, and high school. Mm-hmm. The high school that I went to was, I think that started in like 1990. So it was a fairly new high school by the time I got there in 1993. And I graduated in 1997. Mm-hmm. I considered a number of different colleges and ultimately ended up sticking closer to home. At that age, I was not ready to leave Minnesota. I thought about going to Northwestern University. That was probably my number one choice until I went down and visited with my dad. And he kind of said to me, well, you know, it's a lot more expensive than Gustavus Adolphus College, where I went ultimately. And he said, you know, if you go to a school like this, like, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I think I want to be a teacher or a lawyer. And he said, well, you don't need to go here to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be a lawyer, it really kind of matters more where you go to law school. And I thought about that a little bit and I said, okay, you know, I think I'm a little more comfortable going to this small liberal arts school closer to home. So that's what I did. And then throughout the course of college, I should probably say too, I was a debater in high school and also in college. And my parents aren't lawyers, but we had a lot of lawyer friends of the family, and I kind of always was thinking about that as a career. So kind of did the typical path and was a political science major in college. I kind of accidentally became a French major as well. So I studied abroad and got enough credits. Yeah. That's kind of the way it worked. So I was in Paris for a semester and then came back to small town Minnesota and said, all right, you know, I think I want to experience something different. So then I looked at law schools, decided to apply to law school right out of college. And I thought for a while that I might go back to France and teach English to elementary schoolers. I had done that for a semester while I was over there. And my mom actually convinced me out of it, saying, you know, you should just go on and get your education first, because at the time she was about 55 and just getting her master's degree, and it was something she had always wanted to do, but then she had kids that kind of got in the way. And so she kind of said, you know, I wish that I would have pursued my education more before I started down the path of having a family. So that's what I ended up doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I should probably say, and then I came out here to law school. Uh-huh. At UCLA.
Yeah. And what was that like? How was law school at UCLA?
I loved it. Mm-hmm. So I started law school about 3 weeks before September 11th, 2001. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you know anybody who's been through law school, it's kind of the first year is like a really kind of jarring experience in the sense that like law school is more intense than college by a long shot. Mm-hmm. You know, you show up there and like everybody's really smart and mm-hmm. really capable. And it's a little bit intimidating, but it was the strangest thing because when September 11th happened, my classmates and I like really all rallied around each other. And I think my class kind of has like a certain kind of closeness having experienced yes. that early on. But it was always very intellectually stimulating. My best friends to this day are some of my law school friends.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Do you think that the way you brought up where you lived kind of affected which opportunities you had when it came to your education?
I think so. So I grew up with mother who's a teacher, taught German in high school, and my father was at the time an executive at 3M. He's in politics now, which is a little bit of a different change. But you know, I grew up with parents who had college degrees, and in a part of Minnesota where education was really top notch. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, when I was growing up, there really wasn't, like, it was kind of presumed that I would go to college and probably presumed that I would get a graduate degree, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen that contrasted experience with my husband, who grew up with a mother who was a, like, a checkout person at a grocery store and a father who worked in the shipyards down in Long Beach, very working class background. And I think for him, it was presumed that he would not necessarily go on to college. So I think in a lot of ways, my path was made a lot easier based on like where I grew up and the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there any sort of key points that you can think of that sort of led you to come to where you are now?
Wow, that's a question I have to think about a little bit.
It's okay, take
it. Yeah. excuse me. I think what I sort of alluded to earlier about, you know, studying abroad, and then I forgot to mention that I did an internship in D.C. Also while I was in college, that I think opened my mind up a lot more to living in different places and wanting to experience more like a world outside of where I grew up. And that was probably those two things, studying abroad and my internship, were what really led me to kind of the path I'm on right now.
Let's see. So what would you describe as some of your core values and beliefs?
I value fairness. I value hard work. Mm-hmm. I have a strong belief in social justice as well, and equality of opportunity. And by that, I mean not just, you know, kind of leaving everybody to fend for themselves, but to actually provide those sorts of opportunities to people who don't necessarily have them already. Mm-hmm. Those are probably some of my core beliefs. Yeah.
Where would you say that those kind of got sparked for you?
I suppose it was, you know, growing up with a family who was always interested in those same sorts of things. And my parents definitely made an effort to expose me to worlds outside of where I was in particular and made me more sensitive, I think, to kind of the challenges that other folks face.
How do you think that your definition of gender has changed throughout your life or influenced your life?
Okay. So I think I probably, growing up, I think I was obviously very aware that I'm a woman, you know, or I was a girl. I think that throughout my 20s, I probably had less understanding of how the world was different for women and men. I mean, if you're going at sort of like a binary gender description, and I identify as a cisgender woman. So probably around the time that I hit 30, I started noticing that things were a bit different. I've been practicing law this whole time, and this is as I was climbing up through a former law firm, noticing that certain opportunities were being given to men and not to women, noticing that there were presumptions about my private life that were not necessarily true. And by that, I mean, not anything like salacious or anything, more in the sense of you know, I'm the woman in my heterosexual relationship. And so there was a presumption that, like, I would prioritize having a family over my career, and that my husband would be kind of more of the breadwinner, that I would take his name when I got married, which I did not. And that actually sort of socially, and even Los Angeles, was a little bit of a thing with some people. You know, when we went to go and buy a house, the realtors would talk to him first and not me, even though I was the one who was the negotiator in the relationship. Yeah, I mean, like, there were definitely points in time in my life where I felt very frustrated. And I think it was really, it wasn't sort of at the very beginning of my career, but really as I tried to move up the hierarchy, I guess you could say, at the firm, and into positions of being more of like the boss of other people and trying to develop business with clients, for example, too.
Yeah. It sounds like there was kind of sort of conflicting values with family, the one from your mother where you want, where she was telling you that you should kind of prioritize your education and your career and first get that good base, and sort of the rest of the outside world telling you that your position is as a mother and as a wife more. How did you deal with that sort of those two opposing forces in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was really lucky because both of my parents, and my mom was the one who had that conversation with me explicitly, but my dad had always treated me as basically equal to my brother and, you know, taught me how to change a tire, taught me how to invest in the stock market and like the things that like fathers maybe kind of traditionally do with their sons, like my dad would do with me too. So he was always very, very supportive of me in that regard. And I think the way that I just sort of dealt with it, I mean, was just to work twice as hard, really, you know, and prove myself. Yeah. And it has been a very frustrating process, like, throughout time. I don't think that's ever really gone away. But yeah, I just had to be twice as good as the men around me.
Yeah. Can you think of any specific times where you've sort of directly faced that in your career, in your practice?
Absolutely. So on two different occasions, the first one being at my former firm. So what I do right now is different than what I had been doing immediately prior to this and then immediately prior to that. So I had been litigating as a big firm lawyer for about 14 years. And the first firm I was at, when I was coming up the partnership track, I had to really advocate for myself. And I had a couple of very strong women partners in the firm who also advocated for me too, which was very helpful. The home office for that firm is in Atlanta. And so basically they helped me figure out a way to get to Atlanta and talk to the powers that be out there. And this would have been maybe 8 years ago now, I think. And so I had a conversation with my practice group leader and basically said, I want to be a partner in this firm. How do I get to be a partner? And I want to be in that process to be considered this year. Long story short, it's a 2-year process. And essentially what this man told me was, well, we've already decided who's in the process for this year and next year. And yeah, it's a little awkward, but we don't have any women in the process. Out of 8 people that they were planning on putting up for partner that year, and the next year is all men. So we had a conversation about that. And you know, he said there's a quantitative and a qualitative aspect to this. There's how many hours you bill and, you know, what the revenue is coming in. That's the quantitative aspect. Mm-hmm. Took a look at that and found out that I was more profitable than several of the men who had recently made partner in our group. So that was all well and good. And then the qualitative aspect, your reviews, and took a look at that. And yeah, my reviews were all really great. So I said, okay, well, you know, we'll take it back. We'll take a look at this again. So I said, great, fine. So then I come back to LA, and there's a man who is a year behind me in the process who had not flown himself out to Atlanta, had never asked to make partner, had actually billed far fewer hours than me. So maybe getting into the weeds a little bit, but typically law firms want you to bill about 2,000 hours a year if you're partner track. I was on pace to bill 2,100. He was on pace to bill 1,800. So a pretty significant difference. Yeah. And he had gotten married that year. And we had a conversation among the associates at the time about the partnership process. And, you know, and he asked me, you know, are you in the partnership process? And I said, no. And he was like, oh, good, because, you know, not good for me, but like good for him, because he's like, I need another, you know, a couple of years here because I've had a really bad year as far as billing, you know. And I just kind of, I knew at that point that he was in the process, but he didn't know himself. He never asked for it, didn't, you know, didn't try. And then he found out within a few days and came over to my office and said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. And I said, yeah, I figured you had no idea. And it was a very awkward conversation between the two of us. And so then I called up the guy I'd met with and I said, what's the deal? I should be in the process. You know, I thought we talked about this. And he's like, oh, well, we really couldn't change it at that time. And, you know, honestly, like, it doesn't really matter in the long run who makes partner first, you know, like, it's, you know, 20 years from now, it's not going to matter to you. I said, yeah, but I mean, this isn't fair. Like, I just, like, qualitatively and quantitatively, I'm beating this guy, right? You know? So, and I was basically told, like, oh, you know, just don't worry about it. It's, mm-hmm. you know, wait for another year and everything will be fine. I mean, it was. I did make partner. Mm-hmm. But that was an experience where it was very clear that they were trying to elevate a more junior man over a more senior and more qualified woman.
Yeah. Imagine how frustrating it would be.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like when you, especially like in the kind of, you know, intense world of law firm practice, like you have to really advocate for yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's a double-edged sword, right? Because also after I did that and after I had a conversation with my kind of local partner in charge of the group and I said, you know, the guys in Atlanta said that you guys didn't put my name in for the, you know, for this process. And he said, oh no, we absolutely did. And I'm like, well, one of you isn't telling the truth, you know? And then this guy, I find out, you know, is going around and yapping to other partners about how, what did he say? I was defensive or, you know, I mean, it was kind of one of those things, like he didn't want to be challenged. He didn't want to, you know, have to answer a tough question. And so then it became, you know, an attitude issue with me.
I've had similar experiences kind of sure. more in school and sports, but I can only imagine how good for career. I'm lucky enough to have a woman as my boss.
Yeah.
All female teachers this semester. So it's been kind of a nice break in that sense.
Yeah.
Let's see. What are some specific points that have kind of shaped your view of feminism and mm-hmm. your stance on it and what it means to you?
Well, I don't know. I'm not really a feminist theorist, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't recall the last time that I read anything that, you know, really goes into sort of like the academic aspects of feminism. Yeah. So I think for me, it's always been much more practical.
Yeah.
And of course, just in my view, feminism is equality, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, equality of opportunity for women, you know, and making sure that we have the seat at the table when, you know, there's questions of power and influence. And we'll probably get into this later, but it's the reason why my friends and I, after the 2016 election, established the Heart of LA Democratic Club, which promotes feminist candidates and issues of importance to women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess could you sort of tell me more about starting that program?
Sure. So in 2016, it's actually kind of funny, as I was, I guess, technically an Obama supporter in 2008. I voted for him. I liked both of them. But in 2016, I was very much all in for Hillary. And I think part of that was a little bit what I kind of alluded to before. In 2008, I was 28. I thought everything was equal, you know, whatever. And then I had sort of life experiences that shaped me and I think shaped my understanding of Hillary Clinton and the various hurdles that she had to overcome to get to where she was. So by the time that year rolled around, I decided I have a little bit more spare time in my life. I'm a little more senior. I have flexibility. I had actually changed law firms from the one that I had mentioned before and was at a little less intense law firm, I guess you could say. So I decided to do a lot of volunteer work for her. And do some fundraising. And then I also worked voter protection, went out to Nevada a couple of times and also helped back in my home state, Minnesota, too. Although they don't really need much help. But I worked with a number of women, mostly women. Leadership was women. We had some men who volunteered, too. But for kind of one of the, I guess you could say, neighborhood teams for Hillary, which kind of ballooned up. We ended up with 3,500 people on our list doing phone banking and working with the headquarters office in Westchester down by the airport, and got to know these women really well. We were working from about April before the primary and through the general election, and of course, you know, November 8th of 2016, which we thought was going to be a big celebratory day, and then maybe some of us would go out for inauguration or something and kind of get back to our regular lives, everything changed. So a few of us who got to know each other decided, you know, what are we going to do now? Decided to run for delegate for the California Democratic Party. We won, and so we became delegates with the party, and then so, okay, now we've got this, like, power within the party. What are we going to do with that? And one of my friends, who actually probably is downstairs right now, was part of a Democratic club called the Stonewall Democratic Club, is still part of that club, and said, we should join Democratic clubs. And I said, well, so what's a Democratic club? Never heard of this before, despite being heavily involved in Democratic politics, particularly at the federal level. So we kind of explained it, and then we kind of looked around at the various Democratic clubs in LA and didn't really have a particularly good fit for what we really wanted to do. So then I said, well, I mean, can we just start our own club? So we looked into that, got the paperwork together to get it chartered. About eight of us sat around my dining room table a few nights in early 2017 and figured out, what's our name going to be? You know, what, you know, how do we set up a employer ID number and a PAC, basically, because you had to have that in order to be a Democratic club, bank account, all that good stuff. It's not quite as simple as one would think. And then we decided to go with the Heart of LA Democratic Club because our group for Hillary, initially they were organizing the groups around congressional districts. And I live in Congressional District 37, which goes from like Culver City kind of over through South LA almost to, well, I guess downtown, and then through down to Ladera Heights as well. So like it's kind of like this central LA area. And as we were expanding, we started having people saying, well, I don't really live in CD 37. I actually live in 33, but can I still volunteer with you guys? And we said, yeah, of course. So there was all this confusion about, like, you know, territorially, what were we? And so we reformed as the Heart of LA for Hillary. Mm-hmm. And when we were thinking of names for this Democratic club, that was quite the challenge, trying to figure out something that was feminist, but then also timeless. Like, we didn't want to be the Hillary Clinton Democratic Club. There are some Democratic clubs around town that are named after various, you know, Democratic politicians. But we thought, you know, 50 years from now, like, what do we want to be? So we decided to adopt that Heart of LA Democratic Club name. Mm-hmm. A bit of a nod back to the history of the group coming together.
Yeah. So. Okay. So then what are you currently working on?
Okay, so that's one thing, yeah, as part of the club or in general?
Yeah, both,
okay.
Whatever you
want to
take that.
Okay, well, so today, before this interview, we were actually interviewing candidates for Council District 10 for the LA City Council. This is a district that Herb Wesson is vacating. He's the current council president. He's being termed out of that, and so he's actually running for the County Board of Supervisors and for the seat in Supervisorial District number 2, which is currently occupied by Mark Ridley Thomas, who is termed out of that seat. Ridley Thomas is running for this council seat. He actually didn't seek our endorsement, but four of the women candidates running against him did. Mm-hmm. So we had Grace Yu, Lily Larson, Dallas Fowler, and Aura Vasquez interview with us this morning. They all came down to the feminist majority, and we asked them a bunch of questions, and we deliberated, and I can't reveal the recommendation of the board, but the general membership is going to be voting on Wednesday on that endorsement. So that's something that we literally just did today. Mm-hmm. We're also doing some phone banking, and I don't think postcarding anymore because the election's on Tuesday, but we did some postcarding for Virginia, the legislative elections, which I mentioned is really important with respect to the Equal Rights Amendment. We've also endorsed a couple of other candidates. We were actually the first Democratic club to endorse in the Board of Supervisors District 2 race that I mentioned. We endorsed Holly Mitchell for that. Mm-hmm. And I think only one other Democratic club, I believe, has endorsed Holly at this point in time. She's a state senator in our district. And then we also endorsed in Council District 4, which David Rue is the current council member. We endorsed one of his opponents, Sarah Kate Levy. So we're going to be doing a lot of work for them, getting out, doing some canvassing and fundraising and all that good stuff to try to get these folks elected.
Mm-hmm. What do you look for specifically when you endorse candidates?
Well, particularly how good they are on issues of importance to women. And I say issues of importance to women because I don't like women's issues. It feels like that is a little bit limiting. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of things that are important to women. We ask a lot about homelessness issues in Los Angeles. We had a question today about the public bank in particular. And then I always really like on our questionnaire, we have a question about about the support for other feminist candidates, not necessarily women, but other feminists, which can be men too. And I like to hear that our candidates have actually gone out and done the work. Mm-hmm. If they're coming to us and asking for our support and asking us to do work for them, you know, they need to be part of the team and be doing work for other folks too.
So you said that you like using issues of importance to women, mm-hmm. since that's kind of more broadly encompassing. How would you say that issues of race and class and sexuality and LGBTQ issues fit in with that?
Right. So, I mean, I think there's been a lot of conversation around intersectionality and like the sort of intersecting identities of women with other identities. So, you know, Black women have different issues from white women, not always, but sometimes. LGBTQ women also have different issues from heterosexual women. And I guess I would say that it's a little bit cliche to say all issues are important to women, but I do think that that is true, right? I think some issues might be a little bit more important to women than other people. You know, things like pay equity and reproductive justice, mm-hmm. for example, are the kinds of things that tend to impact women more negatively than men. But I think, you know, all of our rights are linked together in certain ways. And I think we've developed this very close relationship with Stonewall in particular because mm-hmm. we do see our issues as being very well aligned between the LGBTQ community and women in particular.
Mm-hmm. let's see. So who would you say makes up the majority of your club? Of the Heart of LA Club?
Okay. so we are... The Democratic clubs in Los Angeles have typically been older mm-hmm. and whiter than a lot of the population. Race is a challenge in Los Angeles, and I think in many ways Los Angeles is very segregated. If not necessarily exactly by geography, by kind of social grouping. We have a reasonably diverse club with respect to like race and ethnicity. We could be better, mm-hmm. That's something that we're certainly working on. It is a little bit difficult, like in the early stages of forming an organization, mm-hmm. as you're trying to kind of get off the ground to focus on that as well as all the other things you have to do to start up, essentially. We are definitely younger than most of the other Democratic clubs, like by a lot. I think you'll find that a lot of the leadership of other Dem clubs in the area tend to be kind of in their 50s and 60s and even retired. There's a lot of 30 and 40 something year old women, and even some 20 somethings that kind of find their place with us. It's been a little bit of a challenge because women kind of in their 30s and 40s, I certainly am experiencing this, have issues with aging parents as well as young children. So it's mm-hmm. that sort of sandwich generation thing.
Yeah.
We have no time. So yeah. A lot of working moms like in this group, mm-hmm. and we kind of fit our club activities around that. So I think our club has developed a reputation for being kind of no nonsense because we just can't. We don't have the time to entertain the little spats and whatnot. Uh-huh. And we're kind of all about the issues.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, since you do have a bit wider of an age range than mm-hmm. those clubs that you've seen, that different generations do prioritize different issues more? Sort of a second versus third wave feminism? Maybe?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I don't know, because I think... The people that are kind of generally around my age really bridge that gap between older women and younger women quite a bit. And some things I think we end up being aligned with older women a little bit more and some with younger women. You know, before we started this interview, we were talking about the situation that happened with Katie Hill. Mm-hmm. And I think we're certainly finding that older women have tended to be a lot more harsh and judgmental about her and her decisions. Yeah. Whereas younger women have, you know, identified a lot more with the things that have happened to her. Mm-hmm. And probably because certain norms have changed, you know, in the digital age again. You know, I grew up through high school. I had a cell phone, but it was like generations before smartphones. I think I was probably 27 or 28 when like the first iPhone came out. So, mm-hmm. you know, and even digital photos, like I was in law school by the time a digital camera even came around. Yeah. So, you know, there's things that I think are really kind of hard for people to understand between mm-hmm. the different generations and just kind of the way that, like, dating works these days and, you know, what what sorts of things young women think are normal, mm-hmm. where older women would think are, you know, insufficiently discreet, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly been one of the things that we've sort of noticed. I think also kind of thinking back on it, one of our older board members said that when she was coming up and coming of age, getting involved in politics was seen as not really dirty, but like not really something that you would do as kind of a woman, right? Mm-hmm. They'd be involved a lot more in charitable work mm-hmm. and social issues, but not politics. That wasn't mm-hmm. a woman's thing. And I think you can kind of see that, like just in general, you know, and even between the 2016 and 2020 election, you know, you have these women in their 50s right now, mm-hmm. you know, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, who came up kind of after Title IX mm-hmm. and all those laws in the 70s that were enacted that made women's path a little bit less difficult. And you can even see the difference generationally between them and Hillary Clinton, or even them and Elizabeth Warren. I think my personal view on Warren is that I think she had a little bit of a non-traditional way of coming up in the world because she'd split with her husband pretty early on and was a single mom for a while. And so she already kind of had gotten past that sort of I guess you could say the constraints of being in a traditional relationship. Even though she is 70, she's a little different, I think, than other 70-year-old women. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you kind of mentioned sort of the people in your club's perspectives on what happened with Katie Hill, mm-hmm. but I know that you said you are a personal friend of hers.
I am.
So obviously with respect to her privacy, could mm-hmm. you describe what her going through that has been like for you?
Right. I mean, I haven't talked to her at length, other than just sending a couple of texts back and forth.
Yeah.
I'm not going to excuse the aspect of the relationship with the staffer because I don't think that was appropriate. And I think she acknowledged that's not appropriate. And I feel like that's been discussed at length, like mm-hmm. in our public discourse. But, just from a personal perspective, I felt very pained for her,
yeah.
you know, seeing her being dragged through all this. And, you know, I don't know what she's thinking right now. I don't, you know, we're not that close that I would know that. But I think that she will be okay in the end. I think that she will find a purpose and find kind of a new way of engaging. And I, despite my personal sadness about this, I think the focus on like whether she would come back and be elected to office again by a lot of people, there's this presumption that being elected to office is kind of your highest and best use. Like, and like, you know, you've really like made it if you've been elected. I think she ran because she wanted to help people. Mm-hmm. I don't think she thought that she would necessarily be elected to anything like for most of her adulthood up until the point when, you know, people actually like asked her to run and she decided to run. Mm-hmm. And I think that's always been her focus. And I think that's probably why, you know, her leaving is less tragic to me because I know that she'll still contribute and she'll find a place where she'll be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say are sort of ways to have political influence without being deep seated in
yeah.
politics?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, being a part of a club like Heart of LA. I mean, we do endorsements and we help get people elected. I mean, actually, Katie was one of our early endorsements. That's how we became friends. I did not know her before she ran for office, but I was a personal early supporter of her and then the club also. Mm-hmm. So that makes a big difference. I mean, I think, you know, contributing money too also is a way of having some influence. Unfortunately, that's the system that we live in right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, really just being a good organizer too,
mm-hmm.
you know, devoting your time and your effort and getting people together and organizing around issues or around candidates that you like, you know, you can really do a lot of good without actually being the person who's on the ballot.
Does the Heart of LA endorse presidential candidates?
Yeah. Well, this is the first presidential election that we've existed for, and there are multiple qualified candidates I think the membership in general, favors certain candidates over others. Mm-hmm. We have as a board decided that we will not be endorsing in the presidential election,
mm-hmm.
in part because of that. And I think especially because we have multiple qualified women,
mm-hmm.
and we don't want to take away from their support by deciding to line up behind one as opposed mm-hmm. to the others.
Yeah. Let's see. Could you tell me a little bit about some of your role models that you've had throughout your life who influenced you?
Yeah. Wow. Let me think about that a little bit, because I mentioned this. I think Hillary Clinton's a great role model, frankly. I was 12 when her husband was first selected to be president, and seeing a woman with an opinion and who believed that she deserved a seat at the table was interesting to me. And then Chelsea and I are basically the same age, and so I identified quite a bit with like her too. Obviously the Supreme Court justices are great role models, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course. I don't know if you've seen the movie on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the documentary. I had no idea about a lot of the stuff in her background, but like that was, she really had some really groundbreaking experiences. There's a woman who is in charge of the National Partnership for Women and Families. Well, she was, and now she's a senior advisor to it, Judy Lichtman, who I just had lunch with this week, who is this sort of, small, grandmotherly-like, woman from New York, still kind of has the accent and everything, and very casual, but, like, she's the one who got the FMLA passed, as well as really has been behind a lot of the other real pieces of legislation and policy that have improved the lives of women throughout the country.
Let's see, would you say that there are any relationships that have influenced major parts of your life, your identity, your ideology?
Other than family relationships, probably not really. No. Yeah.
How would you say, you touched on your family growing up.
Right.
How would you say your family as an adult has influenced you? You mentioned your husband before.
Right. Yeah, I don't know that my husband has necessarily influenced me so much as been just a really solid partner for me in life. As far as like my brother's younger than me and didn't really influence me necessarily so much. And of course my parents have always, really been strong presence in my life and I've lived away from them now for like, I don't know, like I guess 18 years maybe in total or something. But, I still talk to them, not daily, but like multiple times a week.
Yeah.
And frequently, use my dad for counsel on like various professional issues that I face, and my mom, of course, on a little more personal issues. I'm quite close with my family. I've been very lucky in that regard. I no longer have any grandparents. My grandma passed 5 years ago, and my grandfather on that side, and my grandmother when I was like a teenager, essentially. So, and then my mom's father passed before I was born. She was only 19. So I don't really I didn't really know them that well, and particularly as an adult. That's probably the extent of it.
Yeah. Would you say that the sort of your loved ones in your life, your family, get along with you well when it comes to political aspects?
Yes. So I did mention this a little bit earlier. I alluded to this. My dad's a politician now. Yeah. So he's a state senator in Minnesota, and he is a Democrat. Mm-hmm. My aunt, my dad's sister, who's 10 years younger than him, in addition to her full-time job, is his campaign manager. Mm-hmm. And my other two aunts do quite a bit of activist work. It's actually kind of funny. So one of them is a little bit more of an introvert, likes putting up lawn signs. The other one has like no filter and was a Bernie Sanders supporter in 2016 and regularly she was before she retired a reservation agent for Delta, so she can show up at the airport and get on a plane and go somewhere for free basically as long as there's space. So she frequently goes to Washington DC and like delivers letters to members of Congress and is kind of a bit of a rabble rouser.
Yeah.
And then I have three cousins, two of whom I don't really see a whole lot. One's in Kentucky. She is definitely very liberal. She's basically a hippie. My mom is quite a bit younger than her sisters were. Mm-hmm. So like this cousin's like, I don't know, probably late 60s at this point, and like moved out to Kentucky when, sort of like the Vietnam War was going on, and she was very much a hippie. And then my other two cousins are in the Twin Cities, one I haven't seen in quite some time, but the other one is also very liberal. I mean, basically my whole family all has the same political view. On the other side, with my husband, his father and mother, I think I mentioned to you earlier, British, and like that, you know, his dad became a citizen just to be able to work on the docks, and his mom is still a British citizen at age 80. And they don't really engage on the political side of things so much. And he has a couple of brothers and their wives. So one of the sets of them are kind of Republicans. The other set are Democrats. The Republican ones, They say they were not for Trump. I really hope that's the case. But we haven't talked a whole lot since the 2016 election. So, yeah.
Let's see. What would be some cultural practices that you're involved in? Is your culture something that's important to you? Do you have any sort of religious or spiritual background?
I grew up Lutheran. My background is about half German, quarter Swedish, quarter Swiss, roughly. Not particularly observant. I mean, I'm kind of one of those like Christmas and maybe Easter Christians. And my husband's like completely non-religious. So there's not a whole lot of influence there. I mean, I know all the Christmas songs and stuff, but that's about it. And then I probably identify more with my Swedish heritage than anything else, mainly because that's the part of my family where we actually know people back in Sweden who I've visited, and I've gone back to see like where like I came from. So just kind of by virtue of that, I have a little bit better of a cultural understanding there.
What was that experience like going back to Sweden?
It was cool. So I was there in 2005, and my grandfather at that point had long passed. That's the Swedish part. My dad's father, hence the last name Carlson. It was really interesting to meet those family members. They are basically the descendant. So the elder member of the family was like my grandfather's cousin, if that makes sense. And he had gone back with my grandmother in the 70s and apparently did some interview for Swedish TV and talked in Swedish. And they were kind of laughing about it, saying, oh, you know, I mean, he spoke Swedish like they did like 100 years ago, and which makes some sense because his family emigrated from Sweden in like 1900. And like when you leave a country, that's kind of it's almost like the language freezes in a sense, right? So it was really fascinating to be able to talk with these folks. And then they took me around and actually showed me where my, you know, great-great-grandfather came from. The farmhouse is still there, you know, and it was really neat.
Let's see. What would you say relationship is with patriarchy and other systems of power? White supremacy, capitalism, colonialism.
Oh, wow. Okay. let me think of how to answer that. Well, let's see. So you basically how patriarchy kind of intersects with some of these other...
And how that touches on your life specifically.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, to some extent with respect to capitalism, we were talking about before working in a large law firm and the sort of norms and the need to develop business and be productive and, you know, make money for the firm. I think, you know, that's... It is a little bit more difficult to be a woman in that particular kind of setup just because of the societal norms that, you know, women aren't really supposed to ask for business. Women aren't supposed to be seek money and seek salary. And like, you know, when you're trying to kind of negotiate for, you know, your living, I think you really kind of feel the aspects of capitalism come into that. And, you know, it's same thing. Like I have a son who is 22 months as of today old. And, you know, even just the aspect of taking some time off of work to be able to raise him, I think we're such a hyper-capitalist country that taking any more than like sort of the minimum amount of maternity leave is seen as being less than committed to your job, which, I mean, most economies around the world are capitalist. Even the ones that are kind of social democracies are still capitalist. But I think there are other places where it's like maybe a little bit less hyper-focused on capitalism, where people... value things outside of just the sort of like blind pursuit of money, that mm-hmm. they end up having kind of a better quality of life as a result of that. And I think it's generally better for women. Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect of it. Thinking about, I guess maybe, I don't know about colonialism, but I was kind of thinking about some of my travels around the world mm-hmm. and going to different places with kind of different societal norms. There are parts of the world where, like, I traveled to Egypt, mm-hmm. and looking as I do, being female and blonde in particular, I'm a target for sexual harassment on the street. You know, it's something that's just kind of normal in certain places around the world. And I think there might even be a little bit of an aspect of colonialism maybe to that too, in the sense of seeing someone like me walking around, you know, maybe there's a sense of like a white person kind of being like an oppressor essentially, right? And mm-hmm. and kind of asserting one's position in the social hierarchy that results in, you know, sort of these kind of, you know, this desire to kind of put you in your place, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, so you mentioned your son. Mm-hmm. how would you say that your life experience, your involvement in politics, your personal life, how do you think that's going to shape what you teach him, how you raise him?
So I bring him to things. even, you know, from, let's see, I'm trying to think of what the first, I brought him to the California Democratic Convention down in San Diego when he was 7 weeks old. He came on the floor with me. And he's been to a number of protests and met a number of politicians. And I think it's important to me that I integrate him into these sorts of activities and raise him with a sense of understanding. I mean, you know, and I think about that sometimes, like I'm raising a white man, right? Mm-hmm. And like a very, like, you know, Northern European looking white man,
yeah.
you know, so I want to make sure that he is sensitive to the privileges that he will be growing up with just by virtue of that, and, you know, develop a real sense of social justice himself and care about people around him that look different than him and have different life experiences.
Let's see. I guess what would you say you see for yourself in the future, for Heart of LA in the future?
Okay.
What are sort of your goals moving forward, both personally and within your organization?
Interesting. I am hoping to... Are we good on time there?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm hoping to be able to set this organization up to thrive outside of my own leadership. I'm the president of the club, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier, but, you know, basically kind of set it on its path and watch it fly, because I don't want to be in charge of it forever. I don't know exactly where I'm going kind of professionally. I think I mentioned this to you earlier, but I went out of litigation, and now I'm essentially in-house counsel to a very large law firm. So I advise... internally, I advise the attorneys on various legal obligations and things that we do. I don't know, and this is a relatively new job for me.
Yeah.
I started in June, so I don't know exactly where I'm going, I guess, professionally in that regard. I'm pretty happy where I am.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that not only do we elect a Democrat in 2020, but that we elect our first female president.
Mm-hmm.
I am looking forward to a day when I do not need to feel like I need to be watching the news and hyper obsessed with what's going on in Washington, D.C. I was always really involved before, and I think I'm not one of those people who was like complacent until the 2016 election, but it really would be, I think, better for my mental health as well as everybody else's,
yeah.
to, you know, have a government that is functional again and, you know, is focused on making society better for all people and not just a few. I guess that's kind of where I hope things are going. I guess we'll see. I don't know if this doesn't turn out in our way in 2020, what happens next at that point. I'm not even thinking about that right now.
Yeah. Would you say that your personal and political values influence your professional life at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, yes and no, I guess I could say. Like, cause I keep my professional life kind of separate from my political life. Mostly in the sense where I don't think that what I do professionally influences my political viewpoints mm-hmm. all that much, really. And my political viewpoints, I guess, influence my professional life maybe a little bit more, but more, less in the partisan sense, more like kind of in just general views on like equity, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I've definitely been an advocate for women coming up behind me. People of color coming up behind me, sometimes women, sometimes men. And I believe that we need to construct a world where there's less, in law firms, there's a lot of like kind of haves and have nots, right? Mm-hmm. And like there can be some pretty extreme inequalities between that. And I think that we need to be investing in people a lot more and maybe taking a step back from the sort of blind pursuit of the dollar.
Yeah.
And certainly at the expense of like people's well-being. And I mm-hmm. think that that's a huge issue, and I don't want to digress too much, but it's a huge issue in the legal industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you say that sort of the price of graduate school and law school in particular, I know that personally I'm going to need to take mm-hmm. at least a few years in between
yeah.
college and grad school if I choose to take that path. Would you say that that sort of sets up that sort of dollar chasing mentality and the sort of system of have and have not?
I think to a great extent, yes. So when I came up, I graduated from law school in 2004, and I think, and actually this is sort of, it's interesting. When I started at UCLA, the in-state tuition for law students was $11,000 a year. By the time I exited, it was $22,000. So they literally doubled the tuition yeah. between my first and third year. And then I think now it's probably close to 50. Mm-hmm. Now salaries have also gone up on the top end of the legal profession. Like I think first-year associates, when I graduated, started at 125. Now they start at 190. But not everybody gets those jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a real key, like with respect to the legal profession. And I think a lot of people come into law school thinking that this will be, you know, they've kind of hit the jackpot, I guess, like, you know, graduate from law school, and you'll be kind of set economically for life. That's not really true. And especially if you go into sort of public interest practice or government work, I mean, it's a little hard to pay the bills. And like, you could easily be one of the, like, assistant attorney general, not the attorney general, but, mm-hmm. you know, one of the folks who works in the office, you know, with many years of experience and still probably not be able to afford a house in Los Angeles, which is a bit of a problem. So I think that we definitely kind of have this, with the legal profession in particular, this fracturing between like people who've done extraordinarily well economically and then people who are still struggling to like pay their loans 20 years after they're out of law school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you say that the price of education sort of, financial equality in general are things that are important to you and Heart of LA when it comes to policies that you endorse?
I mean, so we, you know, as far as, I don't know that we have endorsed in any races that really have any direct impact on the price of education, really. For me personally, yeah, I mean, it's definitely important to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that education, higher education should be accessible to more people for sure. Mm-hmm. I do think that in general, schools are, the cost of schooling is far too high. And I think, you know, we do need to start coming up with some more creative solutions to that. Whether that is loan forgiveness, at least to a certain level, or, you know, decreasing the cost of at least public school tuition. I don't mm-hmm. know, we don't really have control over the private schools.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that is something that is holding back young people to a great extent.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, I guess, wrapping up, what would your hopes be for my generation, sort of people who are in school, in college, or kind of on their way out?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's sort of the hopes for, like, the next generation are that, you know, that you are able to have the same sort of benefits that I've had without the kinds of things that have held back my generation, mm-hmm. you know? I guess particularly from a feminist perspective, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, that our focus on trying to make the world more equal and trying to break barriers will lead to it being easier for the people that come behind us. Mm-hmm. You know, that's always kind of been my hope. And certainly, you know, as younger attorneys are kind of coming up through the system, one thing I actually didn't mention is I am on the board of the National Association of Women Lawyers. I'm actually going out to New York for a board meeting on Tuesday night, actually, for our board meeting on Wednesday. And, you know, that's one of the things that we focus on in particular. It's like the equity among women in the legal profession, but then also like in society in general. We're founded by suffragettes in 1899, like 20 years before women even had the right to vote through the 19th Amendment, which I realize doesn't grant the right to vote to everybody, but certainly a good first step in that direction. And that's kind of the heritage that we have that we kind of pay forward, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so we're trying to always make the world better and more equal and provide more opportunities for the women in particular who come behind us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you so much for
You're welcome.
Talking with me. Let's see.